for norms. During the class, or even for 5 minutes, a few hours, or even for days, the knowledge, this vision of I am Satchit-Ananda, is so obvious and so clear. But eventually, the mind goes back to duality and the identification with the jiva returns. Does the identification with the limitless Atma Brahman eventually become permanent? If so, then by what means, Viveka Vairagya, can we assist the vision to be permanent? There's a saying that Swamiji would often repeat, you know, punah punah shravanam kuryat, again and again do shravana. What that means is again and again you keep exposing yourself to this vision, to the teaching, you know, until it just simply is you. So probably, even though we can do so many things on our own, contemplation, studying the text, listening to the MP3s, the audios, you know, I think all of that is wonderful and very helpful, but I think it's good to have that sangha also, that community, you know, where you gather together and either with your teacher or just as a group, like going with doing the Gita home study or something, where there's a group of you together, because together you kind of support each other in this vision. You talk about, you're able to talk about it, you're able to talk about your experiences around it, you know. It's just some sort of it's a very, very wonderful support system that can hold you, you know. And so if you are somewhat experienced or have some years in this knowledge, you can lead a Gita home study or lead a group or give some satsangs or give some classes or anything that you feel comfortable, to whatever degree you feel comfortable, so that you can create your own sangha. So there's like-minded people for whom this knowledge is, the mumukshutvam is there, and this knowledge is the most important thing. But it is, I would say, the most important thing that you're doing is just primary to who you are. It's really owning up this knowledge. So trying to have some sort of community, you know, that can hold you as a group is really a wonderful thing. I know when we meet in Sweden, that a lot of the students that come to the court, the camp, or whatever we're doing, they've gone back into their own community and they start a small group, even maybe with a group of people who are from the same town, like some are from Stockholm or Gothenburg. They'll start getting together, you know, and kind of meet on a weekly basis, that type of thing. I think that is something, that type of a support system is really, really helpful. And then I would also kind of pencil into your calendar whenever there's some sort of a teaching going on. Like this would be an example. There's something going on, we're all coming together, we're having classes throughout the day, and you just get that sangha is there, that vision is there, and you just immerse yourself in it. So whenever something like that is happening, or if you have a teacher in your area where classes are going on a weekly basis, I would participate in that. Because what happens, what it's like, that is like, at least in my experience, you go to a class where you're the teacher or the student, you go to the class, and the vision just washes out all the samsara. It's like taking a bath. It's like your antakarana, your mind is just taking a bath, and everything's fine, and back to myself, you know, and then you dive into the samsara again, get all muddy in there and whatnot, so then you come back and you take that bath, expose yourself to this teaching, and be with a group of close friends who have the same vision. So that's what I would suggest. There's enough online courses. I know all my classes are on, almost all of my classes are, well, all of them are actually, are online. It's a big time difference, but I think that there are other teachers also who have their classes online, so you can always just dial in and kind of, you know. I know that for our classes in Berkeley or at the farm, there might be 15 people sometimes online, and they're from different areas, you know, where there really isn't any teacher in that area. So they just listen online. The time difference isn't too bad. Sometimes the time difference is a little formidable, You have to get up like at 3 a.m. or something. You know? But if not, it's really nice to join a live class because you really are part of it. Even from this, in our online classes, the online students are as much a part of the class as the students in the class, because we know who's there and I know who's there, and I'm, you have the big computer in front of me and everybody's name is there and they're asking questions and this and that. That's nice, very, very nice. So I would just suggest keeping yourself as immersed in this knowledge as possible. As possible and also as comfortable for you. And in that way, that kind of that clarity will keep growing and growing and growing until it's not, you don't need to do that anymore. You may do that anyway just for the Sangha, you know, but you don't need to do that because the knowledge is very clear. There's not any doubts anymore. And also your mind has had and your emotional self has had a chance to kind of settle in and really be held by that knowledge. It's not like your emotions and all of this, your raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, it's not like they all just kind of resolve and disappear in a short period of time. It happens very gradually over time, but it makes no difference because you know how to be with them. So if you know how to be with your emotions and with your likes and dislikes in a way that allows you to maintain your shanti, then you don't worry about them because you know how to care for them. It's like if you have a child and the child has this problem and that problem, but you know how to be with that child in a way that they can grow and be healthy and resolve all of their emotional tantrums and outbursts and whatnot, you know how to be with them, and it's not a problem at all. It's just letting that child, give this child the support it needs to grow. And so that's how we feel about our own mind, places that are immature or, you know, getting themselves into hurt spaces all the time. Once we know how to be with that, then it's just taking care of my own mind like I take care of other people, you know. That's part of, you know, learning that inner friend, learning how to be an inner friend, because then you learn how to take care of what's going on internally, just like you have learned and keep learning how to be a good friend to people. You know, you keep growing in that and learning how to really be a good friend, somebody who cares about others. We keep learning that. You know, we have to learn that not only about others, but how to do that for all of the issues that are coming up in my own psyche. And when I really learn that, and that becomes natural to me, then I have the freedom to allow your knowledge to kind of flower. That beautiful flowering of your knowledge, that beautiful process of maturing, you know. You can enjoy the process because you know how to take care of the aches and pains on the way. So that's what I would do. But even then, with this, it sounds really, so if you can say this, like, during the class, or even for 5 minutes, or a few hours, or even for days, this vision is obvious and clear. That's good. The vision is obvious and clear. It just gets clouded by raga dveshas. Remember raga, for the Sweden people who were at the last month. Raga means a like that I have, a binding desire, I need this to be happy. Whenever that is thwarted, it turns into a krodha, into anger. And that anger is a type of dvesha. It's a type of dislike or even hatred. And so then that creates a lot of pain things in my mind. And so this knowledge can all be so wonderful and clear until this binding desire comes up and it's not fulfilled. And then all kinds of, you know, pain breaks loose out of that unfulfilled or thwarted desire. And so then my vision kind of gets pushed to the background unless I know how to be with that, I realize what is happening and I learn how to be with that. But to be with the desire, the thwarted desire, and be able to talk to it and say, what is it that you're really trying to get here? What are you really trying to accomplish? And, you know, really kind of look into it and let it, that desire and that dvesha talk to you, you know? And then after you've figured out everything that you're really needing and how threatened you feel and how afraid you are and all this, you can slowly bring in your knowledge and let it, the whole thing just kind of settle down. So knowing how to be with these things is important. These obstructions to your knowledge come and go, and you're left with your knowledge. But it's like kind of a wave coming into the ocean and then pulling out again. You know, you can kind of get overwhelmed by the wave, and then the wave pulls out, and then you're just left with your knowledge. Your knowledge always outlasts your emotional pain that brings. Should all Vedanta students become teachers? Well, not necessarily at all. You may find your life just an expression of your knowledge. So you may be a teacher whether you know it or not, because your life is an expression of your knowledge. You may find that you're more prone to writing, but teaching is more, like I know one Swami, she only likes to teach one person at a time. That's what she likes. And it works out well for her. But that act of teaching as a sadhana, as part of gaining your own nishtha, your own maturity, is considered a very, very good, very powerful sadhana. Because when you're trying to explain, so you have a student who wants to know, and then you're trying to explain. In that explaining, all of your own knowledge starts to come to the surface. It's being pulled out by the needs of the student. You know, and then as long as you're not trying to be a guru or somebody special, you're somebody who has this knowledge, a student wants to know something about it, and so you give as much as you can, and when you don't know something, you just say, I don't know, let me find out. Even Swamiji at his age, his 80s, well, let me know, let me see, let me look into that. He doesn't have any sense that he has to know everything. Well, I think there's something in the bread drawn repair about that. He goes, Sakshat G, can you pull out that bread drum? You can look for this. I think there's something like that in there. Yeah. So that's the beauty, you know. It's just sharing. You're sharing what you know, and if you don't know something, then you can find out and share. But that giving, it's true for any knowledge. The more you give that knowledge, the more you teach that knowledge, the more clarity you get, and the more Bhagavan helps you also. The more you give, the more Bhagavan gives you. You know, the more you explain, the more Bhagavan straightens you out, as if something like that. It's very beautiful. So it is not that you have to be a teacher, but if you get the opportunity to talk, to give, it really helps your understanding. So sometimes students will form, even when a course is going on, they'll form into small groups and they'll take turns like teaching a verse from the Gita, or just a chance to be able to talk it through. Because a lot of things come to consciousness that even the things you don't really understand, I guess I don't really understand this. You know, so in that spirit, the teaching is just a very wonderful sadhana. And then after that, then it's kind of up to you. It's not like your dharma, that because you have this knowledge now, it is your dharma to teach. That's not true. There's a lot of jnanis, in fact, who don't teach at all. They just keep to themselves and they live a quiet, contemplative, not life. And I've met a lot of those people that were affiliated with, or were Swamiji's students, older people, and older sannyasis, and younger ones also. They just lived a very quiet life. I'm sure if somebody asked them a question, they'd be happy to answer it, but was not their calling. So you don't want to get yourself into some sort of a trap like, well, now that I'm getting this knowledge, that means I'm going to have to teach, and it's not really what I want to do with my life. So that's not true. If it's what you want to do, then there should be, look for opportunities to do that. Because it's very helpful to you. You say that mind is sattvic, sattva as a material. Sattvic is different, but let me finish this. You say that the mind is sattvic and therefore enjoys my being. But to me, mind can be rajasic and tamasic also. Can you please clear what it means that the mind is sattvic? Oh, that's good. The sattva, rajas, and tamas are actually, they're called gunas, or strands that make up maya. So maya is this, what we call incidental attribute of Brahman that is responsible for projecting the whole creation. But that, if we say the maya projects the whole creation, what is being projected? What is maya? Maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas. That principle of sattva is that which reflects consciousness. Rajas is the activity principle. And tamas is what allows for nama rupa, name and form. And so when the maya projects the creation, there's the sattva, there's three strands are kind of the warp, make the warp and woof of the whole creation. So every mind is made of sattva, and all the sense organs are made of sattva. From Ishwara's standpoint, sattva pervades the whole creation so that the creation reflects consciousness. Okay, so if we say rajas, we would say, as the material cause, we would say, well, rajas is the active principle. And so what's responsible for your organs of action, the karmendriyas and the prana, and all the aspects of the prana, that's rajas. And the tamas would be what's responsible for solidity, for this nama rupa, this physical creation that we perceive through our sense organs. So that's when we're looking at the maya as the material. Made the sattva, rajas, and tamas as the material of maya that projects into the creation. But we can look at sattva, rajas, and tamas as adjectival also. Like if I were to say, for instance, oh, that person has such a sattvic mind. A sattvic mind means that the mind is very, very peaceful, very quiet, enjoys the shantavritti, which means very, it's natural way of being is to be kind of studious and quiet and meditative and reflective, liking to read, liking to study, kind of a very calm, calm demeanor. That person is very sattvic. They have a sattvic mind. So now we're using it adjectivally, kind of look at the characteristics of sattva like a clear mirror that reflects the sun. So a sattvic mind is like that absolute, the clarity that in which my own being is can manifest. It's not because I have knowledge, but because the mind has a lot of dharma actually, and is just has that inclination to be quiet and meditative, studious, based upon because of your past life that caused you to take this birth as an upadhi that kind of is dominant in sattva in terms of your attitude or the type of mind you have. Or you could say, that person is very rajasic. So now we're using it adjectively again. They have really a rajasic mind. It means they're prone to anger. Could be the negative would be they're very prone to anger. They're kind of hot-tempered. They've got all kinds, positively, they have all kinds of energy. That they're a leader. You know, they would make a good warrior or person in the armed services, very, very rajasic. They can be a good leader if it's rajas with sattva rajas predominant with sattva as the secondary. If rajas is predominant and then tamas is the secondary, then you have kind of like a high energy business person, you know, who wants to accomplish as much as they can in terms of their power and money and things like that. So what I'm saying is that we're using these when you say sattvic, he's sattvic, he's rajasic, he's tamasic. Tamasic would be, you know, just like a couch, he's dull like a couch. Doesn't really want to do much and doesn't care. You know, doesn't have a lot of energy to do things, really just sit around and watch TV and take a little nap. That's very tamasic. Yeah. So a talk like that, okay? So that use of the word sattvic adjectivally is different than when we're saying sattva, rajas, and tamas as a guna. Guna means a strand of maya, so that's an important thing to be clear. So that, let's get the last part of this. So if I say the mind is sattva, there are two ways I can say this. I'll say it both ways. The mind is sattva. That's the material that it's made of. It's sattva. Sattva by nature reflects consciousness. Right, so whatever, anything that is made of sattva, so if the maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas, of the sattva and rajas and tamas, what in this body, mind, sense organs is made of the sattva, what is made of the rajas, what is made of the tamas? So we would say what is made of sattva is the mind and the sense organs, because they, by their very nature, reflect consciousness. Sometimes they use the word enjoy consciousness. Enjoy means not enjoy joy, like have a fun time with it. It means that enjoy means that consciousness is manifest in it, right? That it has that relationship by being sattva, it reflects consciousness. That's all that's meant by that. And so say the mind is more so, but then now so that means the sattva material reflects consciousness, enjoys consciousness by its nature. Then if I say that mind is very sattvic, that means it enjoys really a shanta vritti, and I can even, if I were to go on about that, I would say just the natural values of dharma would be manifest in that type of a mind, because when your mind is quiet and not perturbed by a lot of rajas and tamas, that dharma is natural to you. That's natural to the upadhi when it's not being hurt by unfulfilled desires, basically. So when the mind that follows dharma, it's much easier to have a lot of, to be very sattvic, to be kind of very quiet and at peace, because the sensory pleasures are not as important to me as my commitment to dharma. Because just out of experience, I've recognized that with dharma, I get a much more long-lasting shanti than I do through sensory pleasures. So the commitment is more and more just to dharma, what is being asked of me in this situation that I do that. It's very similar to the Kama Yoga Buddhi. The difference is you can be a dharmanishta, somebody who's very committed to dharma, without being a mumukshu. Just be a religious or spiritual person, very committed to dharma. So, I hope that's clear. Let's see if there's another point. Yeah, but to me, the mind can be rajasic and tamasic also, exactly. Rajasic mind is like a angry or an irritable mind, you know, a very pushy mind. Tamasic mind is a dull mind. So we're using these gunas. We're saying it's like that mind has a lot of tamas in it. You know? It's become very dull and rajasic. It's influenced by tamas. It's influenced by rajas. The mind itself is sattva. I think it can be influenced by rajas and influenced by tamas. And then you can feel that. I mean, we have that, we all know what that is, everybody. Even Swamiji, even Mahatma has a tamasic day. The mind is just tired. And the mind's more active than usual. It's just the prakriti. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, just see all of the mind and everything that's happening as the machinations of prakriti. Prakriti means the sattva, rajas, and tamas of maya. So all these things that are happening, all the things that are going on in the mind, just look at this, the prakriti acting out in one way or another. So I think can you please clear up what it means to be, for the mind to be subtle? I think I did that best that I can. Okay, please talk about adhikaritvam. And antakarana shuddhi, what is it and how to increase it? Didn't I do this?
I think you did it.
What happens when the mind is expanded so that it feels the body exists? I didn't do this part of it, I did the first part. What happens when the mind is expanded so that it feels like the body exists inside the mind? What is taking place then? Those are really nice experiences. I remember having one like that once when I was just had come to Swamiji and I was in Rishikesh, at his ashram there, and in the 70s, the ashram was in a big meadow, and you could, if you went in the ashram, if you walked to the left, to the along the Ganga, there was just meadows and forests there, and you could walk all the way up to the Lakshman Jula Bridge, and there was really nothing there. You could, then you could cross that bridge, you know, cross the Ganga, and then walk along up there, and there was nothing there to speak of. Just, it was amazing, just a lot of, on the other side of there was just a lot of beach. And I remember, because I hadn't been in India very long at this time, but the atmosphere was so subtle. It was just so, so deeply quiet and kind of a spiritual atmosphere because so much prayer and all the sadhus were living there and whatnot. So it was very, very subtle. It was so subtle that I had this experience of my mind expanding out into the atmosphere, because it was as though the atmosphere was more subtle than my mind somehow, and it just went out, and the experience was like this, what you're saying, walking through. You're walking through your mind rather than the mind being contained. In the body, the mind is just expanded so much. And I, well, what I felt would happen at that time was that because of the tremendous sanctity of the environment, you know, that experience took place. So the answer to the question, I think sometimes your mind just becomes very, very subtle and very quiet. And you have an experience of the mind being bigger than, being more pervasive than the body, instead of being contained in the body looking out through the sense organs. Right? So these are just their experiences that don't have that much to do with having self-knowledge. They're just experiences that the mind is capable of giving you. Right? So those are kind of a nice experience. There's nothing much to say about them except, in fact, it is true that the self is not contained in the body, and the sukshma sharira also can have some degrees of separation from the body, because it's a subtle body, and people have had those kind of experiences. So the person's being operated on, sometimes they're up on top of the ceiling looking down, and so many instances of that, like if in a near-death experience, you can feel separate from your body. But this is not exactly that. This is that where the mind is so subtle it just expands out and you feel like you're walking through your mind. And that's just a beautiful experience that the mind can give you. There's something that has to trigger that. For me, what triggered it was the very subtle, subtle environment of Rishikesh up at the foothills of the Himalayas. And it made sense. That's how it felt to me. So.
Do you think that when that happens, that we then have somehow access to a bigger part of Giranyavarna?
Well, say you have your mind kind of expand out, you can kind of realize, you kind of, without having any knowledge, and I had very little knowledge of me at the time. So without having any knowledge, you kind of realize that there's these spiritual experiences, little benchmarks that Bhagavan gives you along the way. You kind of realize that there's something more, you know, that you are something more, the mind is something more, or there's something greater than just this physical universe that is holding you. You know, and so that gives you an understanding, a knowing that there's something more without knowing too much about it. And so I think these different kinds of spiritual experiences are useful in that way, because you don't really understand them, but they happen to you. And you can't deny the fact that they happened, you know. So there's a reality to that that makes you want to discover more about it. But say you have some sort of expansive experience or some sort of special type of experience, well, you could say, now you could say something like, well, that's because there's this subtle body that exists within Hiranyagarbha, the subtle aspects of Ishvara. You know, but that's because you have that language and you can know that and kind of understand it within that model. Right? But, you know, a shaman could also understand it the same way, and they would be telling you about that experience, and in your mind you would say, no, that's Hiranyagarbha. You know, that's the subtle body who's now been kind of released into the greater subtle body of which it is a part and all of that. So in some language you would be talking about it like that, whether you're talking as a shaman or as a Buddhist or as a... Buddha also had many experiences. He went to very different lokas and had different insights, different spiritual insights from different planes of existence that he talked about to his students, you know, and they never had those experiences, but they accepted them as a pramana because they had shraddha in him. Okay, like for instance, he had a recognition and experience of reincarnation. He saw, somehow, I don't remember the details, but he saw that there is such a thing as reincarnation, that the soul takes body like a body. He went to a different Buddha. Yeah. So he would be describing all these things in more of a Hindu way, because he comes from the same, you know, tradition. When you have fantasies, does it create karma? According to values, one should let thinking resonate with actions, but what happens to karma effect when you may wish for things that you may not express outwardly? I don't believe at all that fantasies create karma. But say if it's a volition, like say for instance, if you say a prayer for someone, you say a prayer wishing that someone who's say ill, for instance, that you pray that they can get well, and you visualize them being well, that it, whatever form you pray and give it, that's considered a manasa karma. But that is a karma and it can have a result. In fact, they've done tests on that, and they've done studies on that, that show that prayer actually does have a result. It does really affect the one that you're praying for. So if your prayer should always be, you should know that, so that your prayer is always something positive and useful. And we also say you should say, if it's Bhagavan's will and in the best interest of that person, may this person please become well. You know, because you don't know really what the whole situation is, but you know, if it be in the best interest of that person, Bhagavan will please, may they become well, and you visualize them as well. That's a prayer, it's a karma. A curse is also a karma. The prayer will be a punya, you know. A curse is a papa. That's a papa karma, because you are wishing someone ill. It's a wish. It's not just an ill thought. Say if a nice thought comes about somebody, or a nasty thought comes up. That's not a karma. That's just something that's popping up in the mind. There's no volition there. It's not considered a karma. So I wouldn't consider that a fantasy is not a karma either. But now say you have a sankalpa. A sankalpa is more than a fantasy. It's where you want something to happen and you visualize, this is what I want to happen. This is what I want, you see it clearly, and you maintain that visualization or that commitment to that fantasy. It's not exactly a fantasy because it's controlled. It's a controlled visualization. It's just not a fantasy that's happening in your mind. That's a karma, and that can definitely have an effect. So that's why you want to say, if it's in my best interest, Bhagavan, this is what I want. You know, so that you give Bhagavan, you know, last right, so to speak. You decide, but I want this, but you know better. But I can't help wanting it, so I'm asking for your blessings. Yeah. And then you look, you visualize what you want, and you just hold firm. But always say, if it's in my best interest, you know, I would love this. And this is what I see, and this is what I'm going toward. So you can do that. And that is a karma, and that does have a result. But one might say, no. Mm-hmm. That is not good for you. You think it is, but I know it's not. So I'm not going to give you that. That happened to me a couple of times. I was really angry too. Okay, so when you have fantasies, does it create karma? Okay, according to values, one should let thinking resonate with actions, but what happens to karma when you may wish for things that you may No, that you wish for things if it's a volition where you're actually making a commitment of some culpa, you may not tell anybody else about it. That doesn't matter. It's still a karma. But because you're making a sankalpa, you're making a resolve. This is what I would like to happen, but you may never mention it to anybody. But for you, you quietly want that, and you're quietly going toward it, you know? So you're putting that out. It's called a manasa. Manasa means mental. It's a karma that takes place in the mind. If it's a sankalpa, you know? What is the Vedantic view of human actions trying to control nature? I.e. having surgery just to look better, having an abortion, or getting IVF, getting pregnant with doctor's help. Are these behaviors acting against Ishwara's will, or is that also Ishwara? Well, what is Ishwara is the fact that these things can be done. These things exist, these possibilities exist in the creation, and then the human beings have kind of discovered how to do these things. So I said, what is the Vedantic view of human actions trying to control nature? I think humans, in terms of controlling nature, Ishwara, have made just terrible, terrible mistakes out of ignorance and out of selfishness and out of greed and power. They've destroyed nature. Just, it's unconscionable, but it has happened. It has happened in this Kali Yuga. But I don't think that's exactly what is meant here. If human beings are trying to support nature, you know, to help nature to exist and to live and to be able to have a life along with human beings, then that's dharma. But when they're just wiping out nature, wiping out all animals and, you know, destroying the earth, that's not dharma. How can anybody think that that's dharma or that's correct? It's a terrible, terrible injustice to the earth, to living beings. The terrible injustice to different native and indigenous peoples on the earth. So we all kind of know that type of a control, as though I can do whatever I want to you and to nature and to all living beings, is the mind of a rakshasa. It's the mind of an asura. You know, something very, very awful. I don't even know what I'm going to do. I don't want to say all the different horrible words I can think of. It's not good. But now, so there's that level, right? But now here's more something else. What about to control nature, like having surgery just to look better? Okay. Now, people can say all kinds of things about that, that that's good or that's bad. But I think, really, that is a very something like a very individual decision. And some people, you know, for whatever reason, there's also been studies on this, for whatever reason, they really suffer over some physical aspect of themselves or some physical aspect of their face or some part of their body. And actually fixing that up makes a huge difference for their life. Like even, it was so interesting. I had a root canal I had to do. So I had to go to a dental surgeon to have this root canal taken care of my tooth. And they had like a movie on a television screen where they were showing all the different adjustments and replacements that you could do for your jaw, for the jaw. Because some jaws are recessed, you know, and some people don't have a chin, much of a chin, or sometimes the top part is not quite right. And so the person really suffers from kind of a deformed looking face or jawline. And the fact is that that can be fixed. That can be fixed. And so then they can just live a normal life where they're not always having to, you know, put up with the odd stares from everybody. So to me, that the fact that that can be done is a wonderful thing, you know. Then there's also different. They've done studies on this. What is at this time, at this era, what is considered to be handsome for a man or beautiful for a woman? And so they put up all of these different types of features, like American Indian features, you know, Negroid features, different Caucasian features, Asian features. And what of all of these features, you know, are considered beautiful and what are not considered beautiful? You know? And so say a person who has a certain type of features that are absolutely normal and natural and beautiful to that particular race, but then to the majority of the people, those features are not considered beautiful, you know? And so they might undertake, depending on who they are and how they feel, they might undergo some plastic surgery so that they can live with, in the society, with the features that they have. And because of whatever reasons, they can't do that. But if those features are corrected, then the terrible complex around having these features, which are actually fine, you know, is lifted. And so who's to say that that's a wrong thing to do? I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't make a judgment on that. It really depends on the needs of that individual, and you may be able to relieve that individual of a lifelong suffering, you know. And there's been, as I said, I've read studies on this as a psychologist. When you take care of one of something that's really some facial feature, physical feature that's been really hurting the person many years and years and years, and then when it's taken care of, they are so relieved. It's not like, oh my God, why did I do that? It's more like, you know, finally I can be in the world. So I think that's a blessing, you know. I'm sure everything can be misused, but can also be a blessing. Having abortion. I don't have really much to comment on that, except that I know that no one would want to have an abortion. But the life itself might make you make that type of a decision. I think it's a personal decision. You can condemn it, but I don't think it's something that can be condemned. You can condemn it for yourself, you know, but I wouldn't condemn it for another person. The tendency is to say, you know, don't have an abortion, stick it out, make it work, you know. Let life go on, you're pregnant, let that baby come, and give the baby away, you know, have it, let it be adopted, you know, or you can just see how life goes. You can definitely have that attitude, and that makes sense, but it should make sense for you. It should be your attitude. Why I say that is I always would have just had that position, because I would see a lot of suffering that comes from having an abortion that I might, you know, want to just, all right, you know, all right, I'm pregnant, I'm going to have this baby and see what happens. You know? I might decide to make that decision. I would have never been in the position, but I could see myself making that decision and just going with it. That might be what I would choose to do because of the pain being involved. So I just always kind of thought that was my attitude toward it. Until one time, Swamiji told a woman, who this was said many years ago, it's not current, I mean, like 20 years ago, he told a woman who already had 3 children and was older, she was pregnant again with a 4th child. It'd be hard for their family to support a fourth child. They could barely do the 3. And she herself didn't want another child. And Swamiji said, you should go ahead and have the abortion. I was shocked. Shocked that he said that, but it changed my whole thinking to look at everything on an individual basis and not just to make just a judgment. They say, you know, Dharma is like driving a car. You're supposed to stay in the right lane, you know, but if a truck's coming right toward you, you want to move right. Mm-hmm. You have to interpret Dharma individually according to the situation and make a decision. The fact is that abortion exists. It's available to you to make use of that. And so you may decide to do that. And some people feel ethically in all ways this is completely wrong, so they won't decide to do it. Another person would feel, you know, it's a small fetus, the size of a little fingernail, and that it should be my decision whether or not I want to continue on with that pregnancy. And so I feel like it should be the decision of the family that's involved. So, obviously I would pro-choice or whatever. I do believe that it's up to the decision of the woman and the person to make that decision. But Swamiji gave me the freedom to feel that way. Because I was kind of afraid to feel that way. But when he said it, then I realized, I really thought about it, but no. It should be up to the value system and the situation and the decision of the woman. It's not necessarily some big papa or preening or anything. It just depends on the situation. Getting pregnant with doctor's help, I also think that's a huge blessing because I personally know of some cases where the woman so badly wanted to have a child and she couldn't get pregnant. You know, it was just heartbreaking. And many, many couples are in this position. It's heartbreaking. They want a child so badly and they can't get pregnant. But now there are ways like the in vitro fertilization, things like this, where you can really help with that process, and a woman is able to get pregnant and to have a child. So, you know, it's something that science can do, and it depends on you whether you want to make use of that. But it exists, and it's a great blessing to many, many people. And so I'm not going to be one to tell people not to make use of that if they really want a child and can have one. Because now that exists, and so they can have a child. Why should they say, no, the IVF exists, it's evil? Well, I don't know, it's made a lot of people really, really happy. You know, it's really contributed to the happiness of their life. They get to have a family. They want that more than anything in the world. So that IVF becomes just a tremendous, tremendous blessing. And I know one of my students just went through that, and she has a child. She wanted it desperately. Now she has it. It's beautiful. How can I accept things as they are when there are people dying in wars, children dying in the sea, refugees in prison in the camp? What to do with so much suffering? I don't know. I think the thing is, it's not about accepting things as they are and just sitting there. But the fact is that these things are happening and it is painful. You know, and there's many, many, many very painful things that are happening, but some based upon your own sensitivities will be more painful than others, even though all of them are terribly painful. But some are going to be hurting you more than others. And so all you can do is accepting that that is what is happening, what in your life, in your little footprint of a life, what can you do to help? And to just take whatever small or big actions you can take to try to do something that is helpful. And even if what you're doing is seems to be very, very small from somebody else's eyes, for you, it's what you can do, and you're doing it. And I think that that's really important. Swamiji, I got two little stories around this concerning Swamiji. Once I was talking to him alone, actually, I was up in his room, we were discussing something. And he was talking about what was happening in India to a lot of the Indian girls and young girls and, you know, Indian girls who are ready to be getting married. So they're usually young, they're in their teens and whatnot. And a lot of Muslim families, which is a totally different religion, different value system, were taking these girls, you know, and giving and for their son and whatnot. And so then these girls then were treated as slaves. They're abused and treated as slaves frequently in many different instances. And sometimes the family who had given the girl, I don't know if they were paid or what would cause the girl to be given. I don't remember the details. They were given, and then the family was, this girl then was in kind of in slavery at that home. And the family would come and talk to Swamiji, desperate about what to do, how to save my daughter, you know. And so Swamiji would do what he could that would often, in several instances of it, which I didn't know about, he told me about these things, that I wasn't involved when it was happening. Several instances, he actually rescued that girl and moved the whole family away from that state. Put them someplace else, because otherwise they would come after the family and after the girl. Yeah. So he would do these little rescues, which are really quite a big thing, you know, to rescue a whole family, and you have to move the whole family in the world. It's everybody has to go, because otherwise the people will come after those families. So he was involved in that type of work, and also doing a lot of work to kind of reestablish and fortify Hinduism so that they weren't all being converted by the Muslims and the Christians, who are converting religions. Both of them are converting religions. The Muslims are more converting religions by having large families. That's their tack for it. By having large families, then they outnumber the Hindus and the Christians by doing that. The Christians are more involved in actual conversion practices. But by these practices, the Hindus are becoming fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer until many of the states, especially in the south, I've seen a map that maps it out, what percentage Hindus, what percentage Muslims, what percentage Christians. Many of the states in India are predominantly Muslim or Christian, not Hindu anymore. So what is happening in India is that the Hindus are becoming the minority. And the Hindus are the ones who hold the Dharma of the Vedas, of the Vedanta, of the culture. So once a Hindu gives up their culture, they're no longer a Dharmi, they're no longer holding the culture. So from that, in that little pocket, that culture no longer exists. So this is happening a lot in India. And Swamiji just said to me, he said, it's something like, you know, I'm doing everything, I'm doing everything I can, basically to save that Hindu culture. I'm doing everything I can, even though it's hopeless. That's what he said. And I felt that was kind of shocked me when he just went washed through me when he said that. But I've never forgotten it either, because what that says to me in terms of our life is we do everything that we can, even if the odds of being successful are totally overwhelming. So that you feel you may not be successful, but nevertheless, I will do everything I can. In terms of Dharma, in terms of trying to help the earth, or whatever it is, saving the animals, whatever it is that is really pulling you in terms of one, the sadness and the the hurt that you're feeling in reference to this, the plight of the planet and of so many beings. Just, even though it's hopeless, you know, you still do it. You still do everything you can. And the second story that's in line with this is that one day there was a huge forest fire that was covering acres and acres and acres of forest land. And the ocean was on one side, this forest, acres and acres of forest coming from the sandy beach in the ocean, all totally ablaze, so that the animals had nowhere to go. They couldn't go drown in the ocean. So they all kept moving this way to try to be on the other side, free of the blazing forest that was keep moving. And they were all kind of trapped there, saying, what can we do? There's nothing we can do. We're all going to die, you know? We're all going to burn to death. So all of the animals were crying and, you know, in tears and suffering, except for this one little bird. And this one little bird kept going to the ocean, filling her little beak up with water, and coming back to where the animals were, the edge of the edge of the fire, and dropping her beak of water under the fire, going back, getting more, dropping her beak of water under the fire. And the animals all made fun of her. You know, what are you doing? What are you doing? And she just said, I'm doing everything I can. I like this story. I'm doing everything I can. That's our position. We're the little birds. You know, we have to do everything we can. Yeah. So. That's another Swamiji story.
Thankfully, it's me here.
Okay, one more. So this will be it. If there's just one me, how come we have different dharmas? Is karma just an illusion? Oh, okay. The one me is not doing anything. So the self that you are is in fact free of karma, free of dharma, free of birth, free of death. But because non-dual, just conscious being, which is not even objectified as an object in the creation. But this whole creation is a manifestation that comes from that one changeless non-dual me. Okay? Within the manifestation, which would be within Ishwara, there is karma, there is dharma, right? And each one of us, we have what we call the Sadharana Dharma, which is the general golden rule dharma that is shared by all beings. And then we have our cultural dharmas, and we have our individual dharmas. We have the dharmas that are appropriate for our stage in life, you know? And those are, we're beholden to follow those dharmas if we want shanti. Because the dharmas are those, they're like the laws of Ishwara, the laws of the creation on a more subtle moral level. And when you go against them, then you feel that. That's how we learn. You know, it's like, if I put my hand in fire, it will be burnt, and I learn not to do that. I learn how to handle the fire, right? Not to put my hand in it. And it's the same with dharma, a dharma. I learn just by trial and error, and also being taught by your teachers and by your gurus or by the priests and rabbis and, you know, your religion and culture, all of the things you should do and the things you shouldn't do were taught from childhood, because we've realized over the thousands and thousands of years that if you do this, it doesn't work. It causes a lot of pain. You do this, and then you feel blessed. And so we learn what the good things are to do and what kind of the bad things are to do by the trial and error of all of our ancestors. You know, and then Swamiji writes a book called Value of Values, which is so valuable because we end up doing these things, but we don't know why we're doing them. Why is it so important to be like this instead of like this? So he explains all of that and says, oh, yeah, okay, well, that's right. So you have to have a value for the values. You know why these things are important. You have an understanding of dharma and of what happens to you when you do an adharma. You learn that it's an adharma because it creates isolation and pain. you know, an anxiety, anxiousness. You don't feel at home with yourself. Whenever there's any a dharma that's coming from you, you don't feel at home with yourself anymore. You have to find your way back. And then you're relieved when you get back. When you get yourself back, you're so relieved because you got off the track a little bit. And it's not a good feeling at all. So you're taught continually. The Bhagavan, the universe, is continually teaching you and helping you to know to stay within the realm of dharma. Because it protects you. Dharma protects you. Swasti.
Om Swasti Prajabhya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Brahmanebhya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithvi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Chobarahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhavet asato ma satyamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti